The big news over the last 24 hours, or at least the news which is attracting the greatest amount of international attention, is the visit of the Russian President Vladimir Putin to Pyongyang, where he's had talks with the leader of North Korea, Kim Jong-un, and where he has signed, a new comprehensive strategic partnership document. Now, for once, this news, the attention it's getting, is actually merited by the importance of the event itself. Because as we will see, the document that has been signed, the comprehensive strategic partnership, is very different from some of the other strategic partnership documents that Russia has concluded with other states, for example, Turkey or India, or even China. Because though I haven't seen the text of this document, it is absolutely clear that what we're now talking about, as between North Korea and Russia, is a straightforward military alliance. Now, I will come to that shortly, but let's first of all make a few general observations about Russian-North Korean relations, which are much misunderstood and have been greatly misrepresented by some people in Western media, perhaps unintentionally. Now, the first point to say, the first thing to say, is that relations between Russia and North Korea, and before then between the Soviet Union and North Korea, have actually been very close, except obviously for that period in the 1990s when pro-Western liberal governments held sway in Moscow and Russian foreign policy was heavily reoriented towards the United States. Now, I'm not going to explore in detail the relationship between the Soviet Union and North Korea. It's widely acknowledged that Kim Il-sung, the first leader of North Korea, was heavily backed by the Soviet Union, by Joseph Stalin's government. The Soviets supported the government that Kim Il-sung established in North Korea, north of the 38th parallel. I think the consensus now amongst academic scholarship is that Kim Il-sung's claim that he was the major resistance leader against the Japanese during the time of the Japanese occupation of Korea is probably true. This has been denied many times. There's been many claims that Kim Il-sung played up his importance as a resistance leader. There's other claims that, on the contrary, the South Koreans and the Americans have played it down. I'm not going to pretend that I know where the truth lies, but I understand that the burden of academic scholarship, the weight of academic scholarship, has now moved or tilted strongly towards the view that Kim Il-sung did indeed play an important role, perhaps even a very important role, possibly even the leading role in Korean resistance to the Japanese, as he claimed. But anyway, the fact is, he was a communist, he was supported by the Soviet Union, the Soviet Union supported and was the first to recognize the government he established, which was in the north, north of Korea, and the Soviets obviously helped to train his army, build up his army, equipped his army, supported North Korea during the Korean War between North and South Korea and between North Korea and the United States and the allies of the United States in the early 1950s. And anyway, one way or the other, the relationship at that time between the Soviet Union and North Korea became extremely close. Now, it's been widely claimed, or at least it's widely assumed for a very long time, that afterwards, after Stalin's death, and especially during the period of the Sino-Soviet split of the 1960s and 1970s, that North Korea increased its independence of the Soviet Union, in fact, became independent of the Soviet Union and maintained a policy of equidistance between the Soviet Union and China. China, after all, having played a key role in supporting North Korea during the Korean War, the Chinese army was committed in large numbers to fight alongside the North Koreans against the South Koreans and the Americans and their allies. And whilst it is true that North Korea did publicly seek to remain neutral in terms of the China-Soviet Union split, the Sino-Soviet split, I think that, again, the weight of academic scholarship and the information that has come from Moscow, from the Soviet archives, over the last few decades, has shown that, in fact and in reality, despite the public appearance of equidistance, North Korea very firmly remained a Soviet ally, and that the relationship between North Korea and the Soviet Union, in fact, continued to be very close. Sometime in the 1960s, North Korea was formally accepted by the Soviet Union as a country that fell under the Soviet nuclear umbrella. The Soviets continued to supply North Korea with technology and investment and weapon systems. The relationship continued to be very close right through to the 1980s. And the North Korean economy was much more closely integrated with that of the Soviet Union than had been previously supposed. In fact, I've even heard it said that the trading relationship between the Soviets and the North Koreans was so close that Soviet planners in Moscow even set targets for North Korean factories. I've seen that written and I've seen that said. I want to make it clear again that I am not an expert on these topics. I don't know definitely that that is true. What is indisputable is that when the Soviet Union collapsed, the effect was a massive economic crisis in North Korea, a crisis that appears to have led to famine conditions in the country in the 1990s, from which North Korea took a long time to recover, and which at the time, by the way, was assumed by many people in the West, in the United States especially, it was assumed that the crisis that was overwhelming North Korea at that time would lead to the eventual collapse of the North Korean government, which didn't happen. Well, the situation in Russia began to change in the late 1990s. Eventually, a new Russian power system, new government, was established in Moscow, led by Vladimir Putin. And interestingly and importantly, in 2000, just after he became president, North Korea was one of the very first countries that Putin chose to visit. And in fact, if you go onto YouTube, you can still find YouTube videos which show the reception that Vladimir Putin received during his trip to North Korea in 2000, where he had talks with the North Korean leader Kim Jong-il, the son of Kim Il-sung and the father of Kim Jong-un. So there was a re-establishment of contacts at that time. And my own sense, I don't think it's just a sense, in fact, there is no doubt that the relationship thereafter steadily improved and became closer. Now, throughout this time, throughout the 2000s and the 2010s, even as relations between North Korea and the United States, which had at one time seemed to be improving. Anyway, even as relations began to deteriorate and as relations between, as the North Koreans themselves began to develop, to press ahead with their nuclear programs. Anyway, there is no doubt that during this period, China fully replaced first the Soviet Union and then Russia as North Korea's key trading partner. And it's important to say that China, of course, has a long-standing defense agreement with North Korea. It is committed to defending North Korea in the event that there is an attack upon it. A fact that many people know, but which an article in Global Times pointedly reminded everyone of some years back. And anyway, it remains the case that North Korea's major trading partner currently is China, and that is in fact certain to remain the case. And it is also true that the political relationship between North Korea and China continues to be extremely close, and the relationship with China continues to be the priority relationship for the North Korean government. However, just as Kim Il-sung in the 1960s sought to maintain a good relationship with China, even though he was, during that entire period of the Sino-Soviet split, an ally of the Soviet Union, at that time a far richer and more powerful country than China. So today, Kim Jong-un, the leader of North Korea, seeks to maintain a good relationship with Russia, despite the fact that the key relationship for the North Koreans continues to be the relationship with China, which is, of course, a much bigger economy, far bigger economy, and in some respects a far more powerful country than Russia is. So this reflects the fact that the North Koreans have always valued their own independence. And it's true to say that during the period when relations between North Korea and China became very strained, which is the case some years ago, after the North Koreans first started demonstrating that they had acquired a nuclear deterrent and then began to expand it, something that the Chinese were very unhappy about. Well, even during that period, as I very well remember, at a time when the Chinese media and Chinese government were openly criticizing North Korea and saying extremely critical things about Kim Jong-un, the Russians, on the contrary, went out of their way to be polite about Kim Jong-un and about North Korea, and to say that the country, North Korea, deserved to be treated or ought to be treated with respect. Now, I remember that period very well. It was a time where the United States was pressing the Russians and the Chinese to agree to more and more sanctions against North Korea. And the Chinese at that time, who were seeking to maintain their relationship with the Americans, in a decision which I believe they have now come to regret, actually agreed to those sanctions, so that we had a whole succession of sanctions decisions passed by the UN Security Council. Even at that time, when Russia, which obviously had no option but to support China on the Korean issue, even at that time, though, the Russians were making it fairly clear that they were not really very happy with the sanctions policy. I can remember speeches at the time, or comments at the time, being made by Putin, in which he said that the proximate cause for the collapse in the relationship between the United States and North Korea, and for North Korea's decision to press forward with its nuclear program, was US policy that had sought regime change in North Korea and which had reneged on promises that were made to North Korea in the 1990s for economic assistance and for assistance with a nuclear program based on American-supplied water-cooled reactors, promises which the United States, in the event, did not follow through with, but which the North Koreans had accepted in return for their agreement not to press forward with their nuclear program. So I can remember the Russians. I can remember the Russians, even at that time, making their disquiet and disagreement with the sanctions policy fairly clear. And I also remember that the Russians at that time were receiving diplomats from both North and South Korea and were trying to get the two to talk to each other. There was even an instance when there were parliamentary delegations from both North and South Korea simultaneously in Moscow. And the Russians tried, unsuccessfully, as I recall, to arrange a meeting. But anyway, the Russians always made it clear that they were unhappy with the policy towards North Korea. And again, it's not completely difficult to understand why, because this was a long-standing relationship, one in which the Soviets had invested in heavily. Probably there were some people in Moscow who felt that North Korea had been sacrificed or even betrayed by the liberal governments that took power in the 1990s. And anyway, there was a general sense in Moscow that the North Koreans were being treated altogether too harshly. Now, along the way, however, the Russians also developed a very close relationship with South Korea. And this is an economic relationship and even a military one. The Russians and the South Koreans even developed some weapon systems together, in specifically certain surface-to-air missiles. And for understandable reasons, the Russians were not prepared to sacrifice their relationship with South Korea at that time, South Korea being a much more important trading partner for the Russians than North Korea was. Anyway, all of this changed again as a result of the conflict in Ukraine. North Korea became a strong supporter of what the Russians were doing in the conflict in Ukraine. They recognized the independence of the Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics. They supported Russia at the General Assembly they became, in effect, strong allies of the Russians over the course of the Ukraine crisis. And the South Koreans, in a decision which I suspect, again, some South Koreans are going to regret, took the opposite line. A new South Korean president reversed the course of previous South Korean governments, which had been to seek a rapprochement with North Korea, and also began to take a more pro-American line. And as I remember, last year, in advance of Ukraine's 2023 summer offensive, when it became clear that the United States would not be able to supply Ukraine with all the artillery shells it needed, South Korea supplied 500,000 artillery shells, 155 million millimeter artillery shells, which supposedly were being provided to the United States on loan to supplement depleted American arsenals, but which in reality were intended for Ukraine, and which duly turned up in Ukraine and were used by the Ukrainians over the course of their summer 2023 offensive. And that, of course, infuriated the Russians. Now, that set the scene for the full coming together of the North Koreans and the Russians, which we have seen. However, it is important to say that claims that I'm seeing circulating that the relationship has come out of nowhere, that the Russians had shown no interest in North Korea until fairly recently, and that the relations between North Korea and Russia basically were non-existent until the special military operation began, are simply wrong. Apart from that period in the 1990s, relations between the Russians and the North Koreans have actually tended to be friendly and close ever since the North Korean state was established at the end of the Second World War. The Soviets were the main backers and suppliers of North Korea during the Cold War. Putin was already keen to re-establish contacts in 2000, just after he became president. And as I said, he visited North Korea at that time. Relationship remained friendly. The Russians felt that they had to go along with the sanctions policy that their main friend, China, was pursuing at that time in the Security Council. But they made no secret, as I well remember, and made no public secret of their misgivings. I mean, they made public statements to that effect, including Putin himself. And what has basically happened is that one gets the sense that with the South Koreans taking the steps that they did, and with the North Koreans openly supporting the Russians, and with the West's own sanctions policy against Russia, the Russians have felt, to some extent, freed to renew the relationship with North Korea, which I suspect, deep down, they always rather wanted to do. This is an old, reliable friend. It had been a friend in hard times during the Cold War. It's a friend now. There's no real concern any longer about Western sanctions on Russian companies that traded with North Korea, because those Russian companies are already sanctioned because of the Ukrainian conflict. There's no need to worry any longer about the South Koreans, because the South Koreans have already burnt their bridges with Moscow by supplying shells to Ukraine, and by applying sanctions against Russia themselves. And there's no real need to worry about China either, because China also, over the last couple of years, has gone and changed its policy towards North Korea. Kim Jong-un and Xi Jinping have sorted out their problems with each other. They've had several friendly meetings. The relationship between North Korea and China is back on a stable and good footing. So why shouldn't the Russians just go ahead and re-establish the friendly ties, the traditionally friendly ties that they once had with the North Koreans, and which, except for that period in the 1990s, they've never really walked away from? And if you read the very long article that Putin wrote for the North Korean newspaper, Rodong Sinmun, I'm probably pronouncing the name wrongly, but anyway, there it is, the newspaper of the North Korean Communist Party, Workers' Party, you will see that Putin essentially makes all of these points, that the relationship between North Korea and Russia had been a friendly one, that Russia was the first country to recognize the North Korean state, that it had helped North Korea rebuild itself after the Korean War and had supported North Korea during the North Korean War, during the Korean War, that the two countries always had strong and friendly relations, and there's no reason now why that relationship cannot once again resume. So that's what Putin has said. That, I think, is what the Russians think and feel, and that's why they are now re-establishing their relations with North Korea. And, of course, there is many dimensions to this. There's going to be economic ones. I think it is a misconception that North Korea is the economic midget that many people believe it to be. The very fact that it has a nuclear program, that it has a ballistic missile program, that it has a space program with missiles that can be launched into space, demonstrates that it must have a significant metallurgical and machine building industries, and above all, a very strong chemical industry in order to produce the necessary rocket fuels in the necessary quantities. And in fact, it appears to have something of an electronics and computer industry as well, though I'm not going to pretend that I have a huge amount of knowledge about all of this. Above all, North Korea is rich, apparently, in natural resources, and the Russians clearly have opportunities to develop those now. At the back of their minds, the Russians might also calculate that by establishing strong relations with North Korea, they will one day regain some degree of leverage over South Korea. If South Korea wants to re-establish its relations with North Korea, to seek rapprochement with North Korea again, then it might have to speak to Moscow. So the Russians have good reasons to seek good relations with North Korea. But of course, coming back to the military dimension, we also now have a situation where the United States and its allies, including, by the way, South Korea, have been supplying weapons to Ukraine. And the United States and the Western powers recently gave permission to Ukraine to use American and Western supplied weapons for attacks on Russian positions located on Russian territory. Something which I said crossed a red line that both superpowers, the Soviet Union and the United States, had always understood should never be crossed throughout the Cold War. And the Russians and Putin himself said publicly that one of their responses to this move would be to provide weapons systems to countries that were enemies of the United States. And I said in programs that I did after Putin made those statements that it was quite likely that along with Iran, one of the countries that the Russians would be supplying weapons to would be North Korea. And that is exactly what is now going to happen. And it is what the Comprehensive Partnership Treaty, and by the way, this is an actual formal treaty between North Korea and Russia, is all about. And we can say that with confidence because Putin himself has said as much. And these are the words that he has said in Pyongyang. I haven't myself seen yet a English language readout of his words on the Kremlin's website. So I'm getting this translation of Putin's words from Russian telegram channels, specifically from Slavyangrad. So this is not an official translation, but I've no doubt it is correct. And these are Putin's words. The Comprehensive Partnership Treaty signed today provides, amongst other things, for mutual assistance in the event of aggression against one of the parties to this document. So there we are. It's an alliance. It's an alliance in which each side promises to assist the other in the event that it is attacked. We don't know that there is any such provision in any agreement between Russia and China. I am sure myself that there is, but if there is, that has never been made public. In the case of Russia and North Korea, Putin has just publicly confirmed that such a provision exists, where one country agrees to assist the other, to have the other's back in the event that the other is attacked. Well, that is an alliance. And that's what we now have, a formal alliance between Russia and North Korea. And we have also been told, not by Putin, but by other Russian officials, that this new treaty replaces a series of treaties that had been concluded between the Soviet Union and North Korea, going back to a formal friendship treaty that existed between North Korea and the Soviet Union, which was agreed in 1961. And it looks as if this treaty actually goes even beyond those agreements that were reached between the Soviets and the North Koreans in the 1960s, one of which, as we now know, included a commitment by the Soviets to bring North Korea under the Soviet nuclear umbrella. So, an alliance. But then, of course, Putin had even more to say. I draw attention to the statements by the United States and other NATO countries about the delivery of F-16s and other high-tech weapons and equipment for strikes on Russian territory. Actually, this is not only a statement, it is already happening. All this is a gross violation of the restrictions assumed by Western countries within the framework of various international obligations. In this connection, Russia does not rule out the development of military technical cooperation with the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, in other words, with North Korea, in accordance with the document signed today. So, the Russians are now saying that they will engage in military technical cooperation with North Korea. Now, what does that mean? It can mean many things. It can mean the supply of weapons directly from the Soviet Union, from Russia to North Korea, not the Soviet Union, from Russia to North Korea. The North Koreans in particular might value Russian assistance in developing their air force, which still has to make do with Soviet-era fighters left over from the time of the Cold War. North Korea's most advanced fighter jet is the MiG-29. These are MiG-29s supplied by the Soviets in the 1980s. They're now old and probably barely airworthy. The North Koreans will want advanced fighter jets to counter the fighter jets, the advanced fifth generation fighter jets that the South Koreans are developing. And of course, the North Koreans will want help with other technologies. They have a massive submarine force. They've launched their first ballistic missile submarine, but it's been suggested that this uses only diesel electric propulsion. The Russians are the world leaders in nuclear submarine technology. We'll come to that shortly. The North Koreans have shown interests in developing nuclear-powered submarines. And, of course, the Russians might provide them with help with that. And, of course, the North Koreans would probably want to develop hypersonic cruise missiles like the Tsarkon and hypersonic ballistic missiles like the Kinjal, and who best to help them with that also than the Russians as well. Now, I'm not saying that all of this is going to happen. We'll see exactly what assistance the Russians are going to provide, but the Russians will provide assistance. It might not involve direct and simple transfers of weapons, though it's quite likely that it will. But technology transfer, I think, is now all but certain and consistent with North Korea's industrial philosophy, the so-called philosophy of Juche. It's quite likely that the North Koreans will want to establish their own production lines for all of these systems within North Korea itself, and the Russians are strongly placed to assist North Korea to do that. Now, of course, there are UN sanctions against North Korea which prohibit many of these activities. The Russians were never happy with those sanctions, as I said, though they voted for them because the Chinese at that time were supporting them. The Chinese probably no longer support those sanctions anymore. The Russians will mostly do, I suspect, what they always do. They will appear to conform to those sanctions. The technology, the know-how, the assistance to set up factories, and all of that will go on behind a thin, gauzy curtain. Everybody will be able to see what is taking place. But of course, the Russians will maintain some sort of plausible deniability. And Putin actually went on to say that he considers the sanctions to have gone too far. Apparently he made other comments. I haven't actually seen them exactly. I haven't got his exact words, but apparently he takes the view that the sanctions went too far, that they were ill-judged, and that he thinks that the use of sanctions to try to suffocate and strangulate economies is inappropriate and should not be pursued anyway. Now, many, many people are very, very angry about this in the West. There's been statements from the United States that they're deeply concerned about this relationship between the Russians and the North Koreans. It's said to be dangerous and destabilizing. And perhaps it is. I mean, we are now going to have a more powerful North Korea, and with Russia at its economic back, able to supply North Korea with food and fertilizer and industrial products and help North Korea rebuild its factories. The Russians can supply goods to North Korea, which China might not be willing or able to supply, because the Chinese, of course, are themselves constrained by the sanctions that they initially supported. But the Russians, of course, have no such inhibitions anymore because of the sanctions which have already been applied to them. So with Russian economic backing and Russian military backing, and with North Korea anyway having achieved a surprising degree of resilience in terms of its own economy, we are likely to see a stronger, more powerful North Korea appear over the horizon within a few years, more economically stable, more self-sufficient, more food in North Korean shops, a North Korean population no longer suffering from the nutrition issues that they have done, or no longer afraid of famines and all of that, and, as I said, militarily more powerful. Perhaps that is indeed destabilizing. But why should anybody be surprised that it happened? Surely, given the extent of the economic war that the West has decided to wage against Russia, given the fact that the Russians have been stripped of all incentives to continue with their previous policy of keeping their former North Korean friends at a distance, given that, on the contrary, the Russians have now been incentivized to re-embrace their North Korean friends. Why be surprised that the Russians have actually done and are now doing that very thing? Now, I haven't mentioned the repeated claims that the North Koreans are supplying weapons to the Russians. There is some reports that North Korean ballistic missiles have been used by the Russians in the conflict in Ukraine. There's even reports that parts of a North Korean missile were actually found, though I have to say the reports look very sketchy to me, and I can't say definitely that I would accept them as conclusive. And of course, we've heard lots of stories about North Korean shells being provided to the Russians. The very latest report said that the North Koreans have supplied the Russians with 5 million shells. 5 million shells, which, given that Russian shell production this year is said to be 4.5 million, would mean that the Russians this year would have a stockpile of up to 10 million shells, which provides food for thought about what might happen in Ukraine. Let me stress, I don't know the extent of this military cooperation between North Korea and Russia. As has been pointed out to me, and as I have heard myself in the past, North Korean systems, weapon systems, have historically suffered from significant quality control issues, and that probably extends to shells as well. Maybe in the last few years, especially since Kim Jong-un took over, those quality control issues have been resolved. Might be the case. I don't know. Possibly the Russians themselves are involved in developing, in getting the North Korean factories to produce shells. They've already had their people on the ground in North Korea, and the North Koreans are already producing shells for the Russian military and have been doing so for some time with Russian assistance and guidance and quality control checks and machine tools and all that. I simply don't know about that. But military partnerships, of course, work both ways. Putin has just said that there is going to be military technical assistance between North Korea and Russia. And if the Russians are providing military technical assistance to the North Koreans, it is entirely plausible that the North Koreans are going to provide military technical assistance to the Russians, assuming, of course, that that hasn't been happening already. So, again, we see where this policy of constant belligerence that certain political leaders in the West have been intent on pursuing, where it is leading us. It is leading us to a situation where the Russians, a major power, a nuclear power, one with advanced technologies and military industries and vast resources and a huge military industrial complex and the world's largest nuclear weapons arsenal, is, exactly as they warned, making friends, forging alliances with countries that are the West's enemies. Now, this visit by Putin to North Korea is, of course, taking place simultaneously with a visit by the Russian Navy to Cuba. Cuba, of course, is a country with a adversarial relationship with the United States, also going back to 1961, at the time of the Bay of Pigs, the attempted Bay of Pigs invasion, when the US government imposed its embargo on Cuba, which has remained in place ever since, and all of that. Now, as I've discussed in various programs recently, the Russians have been quietly re-establishing their economic links with Cuba, just as they're now going to re-establish their economic links with North Korea. Cuba has been going through a significant economic crisis as the economy there transitions from its old Soviet centrally planned controlled model towards one where more and more goods, the prices of more and more goods are decided by supply and demand issues. And with oil deliveries from Venezuela becoming increasingly spotty, the Russians are increasingly stepping in to supply Cuba with oil and other petroleum products. Last year, Russian trade with Cuba surged, and it is going to continue to surge even further. And I suspect that perhaps in a year or so, if there isn't a political crisis in Cuba in the meantime, which I don't myself think there will be, I suspect that we will start to see the situation in Cuba start to turn round and the economy stabilize, but stabilize in the same way that it stabilized in the 1960s and 70s on the back of Russian economic aid. And of course, this trip by the Russian Navy to Cuba, as many people have pointed out, is simply another visit by the Russian Navy to Cuba. There have been several before, but there is an important qualitative difference because on this occasion, the Russians have showcased not old legacy warships like their old battle cruiser, the Peter the Great, which was built by the Soviets back in the 1970s. They've showcased their most modern and advanced warships. The Admiral Gorshkov frigate, which is able to launch Zircon hypersonic missiles, and which also, by the way, has an extremely advanced surface-to-air missile system based on the S-350 anti-aircraft missile system. I've heard it suggested that the Admiral Gorshkov is the most advanced frigate-class warship in the world, and I have also heard it said that within NATO, it is classified more as a destroyer than a frigate, despite its rather small size. Anyway, the Russians have sent the Admiral Gorshkov frigate, and even more powerfully, they've also, and very unusually, sent the Yasen M-class submarine, the Kazan, which is, by general consensus, one of the most, or perhaps the most advanced non-ballistic missile submarine in the world, able to also to launch hypersonic cruise missiles, capable of extremely quiet operation. There were all kinds of claims over the last couple of days that the United States was unable to keep track of its movements because its operations are so silent. All of that kind of thing. So these very advanced warships have been sent to Cuba on this tour. This is a major show of force by the Russians in the Caribbean. It's the first re-entry of the Russian Navy into the Caribbean since the end of the Cold War, rather than just symbolic visit. This is, as I said, a visit of very powerful warships. It's a show of support for Cuba, which of course continues, as I said, to be under intense economic pressure. And frankly and undoubtedly, it suggests to me a renewed military relationship between Cuba and Russia. Now, that doesn't, of course, mean that the Russians are going to start installing ballistic missiles with nuclear warheads in Cuba as they did in 1962. We're not going to have a rerun of the Cuban Missile Crisis. It wouldn't make any sense for the Russians to do that, and the Cubans, of course, would never agree. But of course, Cuba's military is in an extremely parlous state. Its equipment is almost entirely, well, it is in fact entirely obsolete leftovers from equipment supplied to Cuba during the Cold War. The Cubans themselves have tried to modernize and update these systems, but there's limits to what they can do by themselves. So again, just as with North Korea, we're going to likely see a much more powerful North Korea and a much more economically stable North Korea emerge over the time horizon. So given time, we're going to probably see a revived and strengthened Cuba as well. One with a more stable economy, not, of course, an economy exactly like the one that it had in the 1970s. It will be a very different kind of economy, but nonetheless, a more stable economy and potentially one with much more powerful armed forces and one providing regular hosting facilities to Russian warships, conducting regular tours and perhaps even patrols of the Caribbean. Just as I don't see how any of this works to the advantage of the United States, so I cannot see how any of this, in terms of North Korea, in the Pacific, in the Northern Pacific, so I cannot see how this works to the benefit of the United States in the Caribbean and the Gulf of Mexico. But there we are. Again, this is the place where Western policy, the policies that US officials have followed, this is where it has led us to. Just as the Russians said a couple of days ago, in response to Western missile attacks on Russia, cross-border raids on Russia by the Ukrainians, just as they said that they would supply weapons to American adversaries, we see that's starting to happen with the North Koreans. It will before long happen with the Cubans as well. Of course, it's already happening on a limited extent with Iran, but with the Iranians, it's going to happen much more so in the future. Now, going back to the North Korean visit, Putin's North Korean visit, there are already some people who are saying that the Chinese are going to be nervous and unhappy about this, that the Russians going to North Korea, building up North Korea in the way that they are, somehow treads on Chinese ground, and the Chinese won't like it, and they won't like the fact that Kim Jong-un is being strengthened in the way that he is. Again, I disagree. It's the kind of thing people often say about the Russians and the Chinese with respect to Central Asia, that the Chinese extending their influence into Central Asia somehow irritates and annoys the Russians, when there is no evidence that it does. I think, on the contrary, that the Chinese are happy, and I don't think that's too strong a word, that they are actually happy that the Russians are able to do the heavy lifting for them with the North Koreans, that they're going to be able to supply the weapon systems and the critical economic aid, which, because of the sanctions, for the moment, the Chinese themselves cannot do. It means that for China, there isn't the worry that the situation in the Korean Peninsula will reach a critical moment with an economic collapse of the North Korean regime, that China itself might have difficulties preventing. And it also, in time, will mean that there is less risk of an American South Korean attack on North Korea, if such a thing is ever really threatened. Ultimately, just as the Central Asian states know that for them, the relationship with Moscow is even more important than the relationship with China, important though that is, so the North Koreans know that however useful and important the relationship with Russia is going to become, ultimately it is China that is the colossus, and it is with China that the priority relationship lies. I think all of these parties, the Chinese, the Russians, and the North Koreans, understand this very well, and I think that Putin almost certainly discussed in detail his forthcoming visit to North Korea with Xi Jinping when he was in Beijing 2 weeks ago. And I am also sure that this visit and all of the groundwork that's been laid out has been agreed with the Chinese, probably over many, many long months of discussions. We've had a commentary about Putin's visit to North Korea from Global Times, as it happens. And it says this: due to NATO's expansion in Europe and the ongoing Russia-Ukraine conflict and the US-led military alliances in Northeast Asia targeting Pyongyang, the deeper cooperation between Russia and North Korea is no surprise. Cui Heng, a research fellow from the Center for Russian Studies of East China Normal University, told Global Times that it is a rational choice for Moscow and Pyongyang to cooperate, and any significant cooperation between Russia and North Korea could make the United States concerned or even frightened. This means Washington's approach in past decades has failed to weaken and isolate these two countries, as they're now standing closer with each other and becoming more powerful than before through cooperation. Russia and North Korea are both important neighbors of China, and the three countries share interests in safeguarding regional peace and stability and in opposing bloc confrontation and hegemony, Chinese analysts say. On Thursday, Lin Qian, a spokesman of the Chinese Foreign Ministry, said at a routine press conference in response to a question about the Russian president's visit to North Korea that China welcomes Russia to cement and grow ties with countries they have traditional friendship with. So there we are. The Chinese are not bothered or worried about this. They've almost certainly been consulted and have approved it. Now, North Korea is not the only important Asian country that Putin is visiting. He's also going to visit Vietnam, a burgeoning, rapidly growing economy, an old Soviet and Russian ally, just as North Korea was, a country with which Russia has always maintained very friendly and good relations, and a country which, unlike North Korea, is apparently planning to join the BRICS. Vietnam has also historically had prickly relations with China. The two countries fought a brief but very savage border war in 1979. However, one gets the sense that the Vietnamese and the Chinese have, to a great extent, ironed out their problems with each other, though tensions exist. Once more, the fact that the Russians are reaching out to the Vietnamese and that the Vietnamese are seeking to develop their relations with the Russians, is going to be welcomed in Beijing better, the Russians in Hanoi, than the Americans. And from a Chinese point of view, anyway, Vietnam's government over the last couple of years has been very careful to keep the United States at a distance, something which has been welcome in Beijing. Anyway, we'll see where all this goes. Economic relations between Vietnam and Russia probably contain much promise. China is by far Vietnam's biggest economic partner. The trade relationship between Vietnam and China has an annual turnover of about $200 billion. Vietnam's trade relationship with the United States on annual terms stands at about $100 billion. The trade relationship between Russia and Vietnam is only $5 billion, but it is growing fast at a rate of about 8% a year. Probably Putin's primary concern will be to boost that significantly, and we could very well be seeing another big step forward in relations between Russia and Vietnam. But I'm going to cover that leg of Putin's trip in more detail in my next program. Anyway, that's what I wanted to say about the relationship between China, Russia, North Korea, Russia, Cuba, all of these partnerships and alliances are being forged, even as we return to bloc politics, something which everybody says they regret, even as it happens at an ever faster pace with the Russians and the North Koreans now forging a straightforward military alliance with each other. Now, let's revert quickly for the last leg of our program to what is happening on the Ukrainian battlefronts. First thing to say is that apparently it was a relatively quiet day in Kharkiv region yesterday. Ukrainian counterattacks appear to have run out of steam, at least for the moment. The Ukrainians continue to claim that they've made advances in one or two areas, but it's been very difficult to confirm this. Group of forces north say that all Ukrainian counterattacks have been repelled and that the Ukrainians have failed to find any weak points in the Russian defenses. The group of forces north, however, also say that the political imperative for the Ukrainians to show progress in the battlefields in Kharkiv region remain as strong as ever. There's a strong probability, therefore, that the Ukrainians are going to launch a series of savage attacks on Russian positions and will try, even if at the price of exceptional losses, to capture at least one village somewhere on the battlefronts. Nadima at the Military Summary Channel says that these comments from Group of Forces North suggest that the Russians expect that that the Ukrainians at some point are going to be able to recapture the village of Glubokoye near Lipsy. And I think that he could very well be right. Elsewhere, however, in Volchansk, it seems as if it is the Russians who continue to make progress. There are reports this morning that the Russians, well, control at least 80 to 90% of the aggregate plant. There have been repeated claims that the Russians have captured it, the entirety of it. The Russians have never confirmed that. It seems these reports about the Russians controlling 80 to 90% of the aggregate plant are coming now from more reliable sources. It's clear that Russian communications with their assault forces in the aggregate plant area are indeed stable. And the Russians say that they have again enlarged their area of control in Volchansk, and that Ukrainian counterattacks in this area have subsided for the time being. Now, that's the sideshow, the Kharkiv area. Though, before I leave it, I will say that Abdi Alaudinov, the head of the Ahmad forces, the Chechen forces, has made some comments about the fighting in Kharkiv region, and it is very interesting. He says this, and he's reported by TASS as having said this: the Russian Defense Ministry, all in all, has really made some very serious gains in Kharkiv region. As it happens, quite a serious territory has been liberated. The Ukrainians were forced to redeploy forces. They even pulled everyone out of Kiev region and redeployed them to this area. We are now waiting for our enemy's next step as they're trying to assemble certain forces and make some decisive step. And then TASS quotes Alaudinov saying that this could be a decisive battle in which the Russians could destroy the remaining enemy assets. After that, as I said earlier, we will be wrapping up the special military operation this year, bringing it to an end. Now, that seems to me to accord with what I said in my program yesterday, that if the Ukrainians launch a counterattack, a big counterattack in the Kharkiv region, and are defeated and suffer heavy losses, and do so in such close proximity to Kharkiv, then they might risk losing Kharkiv itself, and that could provoke the final conclusive crisis for the entire Ukrainian state. We'll see. Note that Alaudinov has again said that he expects final victory to be achieved in Ukraine this year. We've had, in the meantime, a whole succession of reports that the Russians have now activated a new front in the Gorlovka area, and that they're attacking head-on the Ukrainian positions in the towns of Toretsk and New York. In fact, there's reports that they've actually reached the outskirts of New York. This is a village. And that they have broken into some of the suburbs of Toretsk itself. I have to say, if this report of progress by the Russians is true, then the Russians are making very rapid advances in a very heavily fortified area. And that would suggest that Ukrainian forces in this area have already been weakened. But I'm not sure that these reports really are true. All of this, however, takes us back to the big story of the last couple of weeks, which is the enormous advances that the Russians have been undertaking in the Ocheretino Avdeevka area, and the fact that they have, since the capture of Novoalexandrovka, which the Ukrainians continue to confirm, and which, by the way, was confirmed apparently by the British Ministry of Defence, just saying, even though the Russians themselves have not formally announced the capture of this village. Anyway, that the Russians are now very close to the main supply line from Pokrovsk to Konstantinovka, but that this is in effect the key supply line for the Ukrainian forces in Toretsk and New York. So it could be that a major envelopment operation is now starting, that the Russians, having almost reached the main supply line further west, interrupting the supplies to the Ukrainian forces in Toretsk and New York, think that this is now the moment to start increasing the pressure on those Ukrainian forces in Toretsk and New York. And that, of course, has multiple advantages from a Russian point of view. It burns up Ukrainian supplies. The Ukrainians will have to burn up ammunition, drones, weapons, tanks, all the rest to try to hold the Russians back, even as their supply lines start to weaken. And of course, it sets up the conditions for a major Russian push to break the Ukrainian forces in Toretsk and New York once the road is indeed cut and once the Russians have captured various villages to the east of this grouping in Toretsk and New York. Villages, for example, like Oleksandropil, which the Russians are reported also to be advancing towards. We can see how a major encirclement battle, a true cauldron, is starting to emerge. There have also been reports over the last 24 hours that the Russians have captured a significant hill area close to Chasiv Yar on the northern flanks of Chasiv Yar. It looks as if the Russians are preparing for a major battle to capture Chasiv Yar and to attack Konstantinovka from the north, even as they seem to be working towards pinning Ukrainian forces down in Toretsk and New York, whilst cutting the supply lines to those forces in the west by capturing places like Novoalexandrovka and cutting the roads there. When I say that this is starting to look like a cauldron, I don't mean the kind of mini cauldrons that we have seen, the kind of cauldrons that emerged in places like Mariupol, for example, where several thousand Ukrainian troops got cut off in Mariupol and were eventually forced to surrender. Rather, it looks as if the Russians are preparing the ground for an encirclement of an entire Ukrainian army group. The force that is defending Konstantinovka and Chasiv Yar, and the force that is defending Toretsk and New York. An army group that probably numbers tens of thousands of men, an encirclement operation that might be closer to the sort of things that we saw happen during the Second World War than anything we have seen up to now. All of this coming as Russian officials, again, speak in very tough terms about Ukraine's prospects. The latest comments, for example, have been made by Sergei Ryabkov, Russia's deputy foreign minister. The TASS report about his words reads as follows: comments on statements by NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg that the condition for Ukraine's entry into NATO will be its victory in the conflict with Russia. Ryabkov said, "This means it will never happen. I hope Mr. Stoltenberg understands this. He knows better than I how the notorious decision of 2008 was prepared, when NATO leaders wrote at the highest level that Ukraine would become a member of NATO. This became the trigger for much of the entire crisis that we are observing today. If NATO members are ready to fall into the same trap again, and history teaches them nothing, then they will get hit again, and their bruises will get worse. As to Ukraine joining NATO, I think this is ruled out." So the Russians taking a very hard line, and of course Putin meeting with his top military commanders a couple of days ago before he spoke to the Russian Foreign Ministry Board to hear their plans. It does look to me as if something very big is about to happen, and that all the pieces are gradually being put into place. Well, this is where I'm going to finish the program today. No doubt more about Ukraine and what's happening there tomorrow. But as I said, this is where I will finish my program. Let me remind you again that you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar, links under this video. Don't forget to check out our shop, where you can also find all sorts of amazing things: magic mugs, hats, hoodies, t-shirts, sweatshirts, all those great things. And last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.